Good morning. It's 11:16, and you're listening to On the Air with Glenn Coble. And today we have a special guest, and our special guest is Fred Malone. Fred's talking about all sorts of things about inaugurals.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting subject, and even if we can't find a whole lot about what went on with some of the inaugurations, we know that they've been held ever since Washington was elected that many years ago.
Yeah. I listened to an interesting song on the musical Hamilton about Washington's no longer going to run, and it's a terrific song.
For a long time I fought watching that play. I just couldn't, in my mind, I couldn't associate hip hop with Alexander Hamilton and the Founding Fathers.
Yeah, it's a stretch.
But myself and my wife and Tom Batchelder, who is Benjamin Harrison, his wife, and we got together over the past summer and watched it on Disney. And the thing of it is, and we had another historian with us, the place Franklin Roosevelt. There were three historians watching this, and I think the women kind of got upset periodically because, not so much Tom's wife, because she's kind of a historian as well, but we kept stopping it every so often to talk about whether this was historically correct or not, and actually they did a pretty decent job staying with the history of what took place.
I don't think
time,
it was intended to be a literal history.
No, but you know, it's still kind of hard to see Alexander Hamilton hip-hopping.
Yeah, I understand. Well, we're up to Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, Thomas Woodrow Wilson, who defeated William Howard Taft in that three-man race to take over as president in 1913. Mm-hmm. Thomas Woodrow Wilson actually dropped his first name while he was a boy. So we always refer to him just as Woodrow Wilson.
Thomas is a lot easier to pronounce than Woodrow for me.
Well, yeah, but for some reason, and I really don't know why he dropped that first name. I couldn't find any information as to why he dropped it, but he did, so we really only know him as Woodrow Wilson.
Yep.
He came to the presidency really by kind of an unusual path. He was president of Princeton University. He'd never really held any political office. He'd never taken more than a theory's interest in politics when, at 53 years of age, he was out golfing one afternoon in 1910 and was approached by someone to tell him that he had received a nomination for the governorship of New Jersey.
Surprise!
So he went from being president of Princeton University to the governor of New Jersey, and a mere 2 years later, he was elected president of the United States. So,
wow.
Unlike most of our presidents who had some background, he was one of those ones that had very little.
Looks very university presidential.
He did. He really did. He did look a little historically presidential.
Yeah.
He looked more like a university president, although right. I'm thinking back to when I was in college at a high university. Harry Cruson was president of the university then, and Harry didn't look too presidential. Do you remember Harry?
I wasn't there at the time, but I'm sure that he looked a lot different after he left there, because that was a rough time to be
in. It was a rough time, and actually Harry ran for Congress, and I think we were in the 4th District at that particular time, ran for Congress and was unsuccessful, but I liked him. He was a nice guy. I helped on his campaign for Congress, but I digress, which often I do.
That's all right. We're learning stuff.
He was inaugurated 1913. His wife died in the White House on August 6th of 1914. So just a little over a year in office, his wife passed away. We'll talk a little bit more about that here as we progress. This, I think, is kind of interesting. The country and Congress was kind of electrified when President Wilson, at a special session of Congress, just a month after his inauguration, walked into the House chamber and delivered his message in person. Not since John Adams had a president address Congress.
Oh, my.
in this brief address, he summarized his policy and appointed recommendations of things that had to be done. So I guess you could say that this is when the State of the Union was officially born.
Yeah, that's because, what it sounds like.
Yeah. And it was unannounced, basically. He just kind of showed up and walked in and did his thing. Less than a year after his first wife died, maybe August, he remarried. He married Edith Galt, who was a 43-year-old widow of a Washington jeweler, who he had met while on one of his morning walks. He used to window shop on his morning walks. He had a Secret Service agent that walked along with him. He was a rather brisk walker, and he liked to window shop. That's where he first met this Mrs. Galt. A year after his wife died, they were remarried. They married on December 18th, 1915, in the White House. His second inauguration occurred on March the 4th of 1917, and really about the only notable thing about the inauguration that was noted in what information I found out about it, it was the last time that an open horse-drawn carriage was used at an inauguration. An open horse-drawn carriage. From that point on, they used cars.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And, of course, we know that during Wilson's time in office, World War I took place, of which we became a part of, fighting the Germans. Not a particularly good war in the fact that a lot of mustard gas, poisonous gases were used at that time.
Horrible war, yeah.
They were later outlawed by the Geneva Convention, but a lot of men not only died but suffered terrible lung issues for the rest of their lives, their short lives, after the war was over. So it wasn't a great thing at all.
Well, he took a lot of grief about it, too.
Yes, he certainly did. And, of course, during his second term, you know, he suffered that stroke in the White House. And for quite some time, well over a year and a half, I believe, if I remember my history correctly, no one saw him. He was basically put away by his wife, and she was the one that told about what was going on. Even cabinet members weren't allowed to see him. So there was a lot of speculation at the time that they actually referred to her as Madam President, because she was kind of like running the show. He did manage to survive the balance of his second term, but then died not too awfully long after he left office. I want to say maybe 1924. He did survive Warren Harding, his predecessor, but not by very much. Harding died in 23, and he died in 24. So, but anyway, the election of 1920, very important one for the folks of Marion and Marion County and Ohio. Again, we're electing an Ohio man as President of the United States, Warren Gamaliel Harding, Ohio's contribution. Again, he was the seventh claimed Ohio president. Of course, you know, we have the one Harrison that is claimed by Indiana and Ohio, so we have a problem there once in a while. But he was a typical Main Streeter of the 1920s in Marion, of course, we know, where he lived most of his life. He was the owner of the local newspaper. He was the director of the bank, director of a lumber company and the telephone exchange. He played the cornet, the Marion band. He liked to chew tobacco, smoke cigars,
and he lived
play
about,
poker.
And he lived about five blocks from right here.
He was a joiner. He was very popular with the hometown folks. He was very, very kind, a very sympathetic man. For 36 years, he published the Marion Star. He never dismissed a single employee in the 36 years that he was the owner and operator.
No wonder he was well-liked.
He was soft-hearted to a fault. He could not believe that there was evil in any man. Unfortunately, he never learned to say no. He often was quoted as having said, and I quote, "It's a good thing I am not a woman. I would always be pregnant." I cannot say no.
That's a little rough.
He once told this to some of his press club friends. And of course, you know, during the election of 1920, he had a special little house built on the back of his property there for mm-hmm. the press to work out of, which remains to be a part of the new presidential conflab, or whatever you want to call it, that is scheduled to open, I think, sometime this year.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. In 1891, when he was 26 and on his way to becoming Marion's leading citizen, he married Florence DeWolf Kling. Mm-hmm. Now, he had never been married before, but she had. She was a daughter of Amos Kling, who was a very influential, wealthy businessman here in Marion. He was a banker and owned several different businesses himself. He never had a son, so she was kind of a tomboy from what I've been able to read about her. I have read a couple of books about her, and she was a very interesting woman. She was very ambitious. She was really the pusher in the family, and probably one of the reasons for his success and his acceptance of the nomination of running for president. I don't think, from what I've read about him, that he ever wanted to be president. He was very happy being a senator from Ohio. He had run for governor in Ohio and was defeated, but was appointed by the, in those days, the House, the state legislature in Ohio appointed the senators. They weren't elected by the people. So he was actually appointed to a Senate seat. He enjoyed being senator. He could still play golf and do the things that he liked to do, play poker and kind of have the run of the place. So he really wasn't the one that had the ambition. Based on her consultations with her astrologer, she felt that the time was right. He should accept the nomination, and he did. Didn't get it on the first go-around. Again, he's kind of like Garfield. It was 20-some, I think, ballots before he was the dark horse candidate that succeeded.
What was the longest number of ballots?
Of any presidential election?
You said 37.
I'm going to say, just off the top of my head, I'm going to say Garfield's was probably one of the largest, one of the longest, And then maybe Harding's came after that. Harding looked like a president, though.
Yes, he did.
A lot of people, there's a lot of portraits of him around, especially in Marion. We have some portraits of him up at the museum. He was very, very handsome, big framed. He was kind of a large man. He had wide set eyes. They say he had a pleasant, resonant voice. I've never heard his voice. However, I think if you go on the internet, there are some speeches that you can find on there. And I know that down at the Harding home, they have, I think, some photograph records that of some speeches that he made that they oftentimes play for people that you can hear his voice. But I personally have never heard it. Of the many people who were impressed by his personality was a Harry Doherty. Have you heard that name before?
No, I have not.
Harry Doherty was a politician from Washington Courthouse. He was, if I remember correctly, he was a prosecuting attorney in there, but he was a very big part of the political party in Ohio at that time.
Fred, we're going to have to break here in about 5 seconds.
Okay.
Hang on.
Yep.
I've got my milk and my bowl and my saucer.
Sounds like you're getting ready for breakfast. What are you having?
Well, I'm having a bowl of Golden Grahams with a side of toast with golden butter and a nice golden glass of apple juice.
I should have known. WWGH Radio, 107.1 FM, The Talking Place.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the US Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt US Kids, and the Ad Council.
Yeah, we're back here with Fred Malone, and we're talking about our hometown boy made good and the inauguration of Harding. And go ahead.
Well, as I said, he was the first time they met, Harry Doherty was really impressed with Harding. Mm-hmm. The first time they met, he saw this big genial man, and right away he thought about the possibilities of him becoming president because he was so presidential looking.
Mm-hmm.
Really, if you look back through him, through our presidential people, with the exception of maybe John Kennedy, he was probably one of the most presidential looking of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
He found something very stunning about his looks, and he's really kind of the one that became his protege, treated him as his protege, and was one of the strong influences of him becoming a presidential candidate, as well as what Florence's influence had on him. The 1920 Republican Convention shaped up to be a fight between General Leonard Wood and a guy by the name of Frank Loudon, who was governor of Illinois. Behind them came several other possible candidates, Senator Johnson of California, a Nicholas Butler, who was a president of Columbia University, and then, of course, Harding's name was far down the list, but Dorey, who had this plan that he'd been working on for a long time. Foreseeing this deadlock convention because of so many people that were interested in the nomination, Dorey told a reporter what he thought about what could take place. After the other candidates failed, the leaders, of course, were pretty worn out. They'd had all these caucuses and all these ballots, and they just could not shake anybody out.
And too many cigars and wine.
Too many cigars and wishing to do the very best thing. He tried to get some together in a smoke-filled hotel room about 2 o'clock in the morning. There were about 15 bleary-eyed men from lack of sleep, perspiring profusely, as you can imagine, because of the heat, sitting around this big table, and he presents them the name of Senator Warren G. Harding from Marion, Ohio. When that time comes, Harding will be selected. Dorey proved to be an amazing prophet because it came off almost exactly as he predicted. These bleary-eyed leaders at 2:11 a.m. exactly decided that Harding was the man. And even though he did not want the presidency, he wanted to remain in the Senate for the rest of his life. He was pretty much forced into accepting the nomination because of Harry Dorey, and also because of his wife, Florence.
Okay.
At his inauguration, there were some 100,000-plus people there, one of the largest inaugurations up until that time. Obviously, travel was a little more available in those days than it was for some of his predecessors. Harding never did any campaigning other than from his front porch here in Marion, Ohio.
Yep.
He didn't travel around. Front porch campaign from what McKinley had done a number of years before.
Yeah.
McKinley never left Canton during the presidential election season. He stayed on his porch in Canton, Ohio, and people came to see and hear him. So he kind of patterned after McKinley, and it was successful, obviously. He was elected by one of the largest landslides up to that time. And he, in fact, became the first president to speak over the air on the radio. The radio started to become prevalent in some people's homes in 1920. In 1920, there were only 5,000 receiving sets in the United States. But over the next year, 2.5 million people owned radios.
Oh my goodness!
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's crazy.
500,000 to 2.5 million in a little over a year.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the first one to speak over the air at the Minnesota State Fair in September of 1920. And of course, we all know that unfortunately he died in office.
Yeah.
While he was on a trip to Alaska. He was the first sitting president to go to the territory of Alaska at that time. They left Washington, D.C. by train, and when they left Washington, he wasn't really in the best of health. He had been having some problems. He had gained quite a bit of weight since having been elected president. For one thing, he wasn't doing his daily walks like he did when he was in the Senate and when he was still back in Marion running the newspaper. He wasn't playing as much golf as he did. He used to play golf almost daily. But the rigors of being president, not giving him the time that he needed for his lifestyle to get any exercise, maybe drinking a little bit too much, eating a little bit too much, smoking a little bit too much, he gained some weight. And when they left on that trip, he was actually showing some signs of congestive heart failure. The trip was very hard on somebody that was in great health, let alone someone that was suffering the problems that he was suffering. They made it to Alaska. He had something going on every day of the trip. By the time they got to San Francisco on the leg home, he was so ill when they got to the San Francisco hotel that he, well, they actually wanted to take him to the hospital when they got to San Francisco, but Hardy wouldn't have it. He wanted to walk into the hotel on his own, and did so, but once he got into the hotel, he collapsed. And Dr. Sawyer, who was his attending physician in Marion, had been taken to Washington with the Hardys when they went, because he was also Florence's doctor when she had a lot of problems, especially with her kidneys. He was with him, as well as a young Navy doctor who was actually the White House physician. And they, too, ministered to him as best they could. For a while, they thought he was going to recover. He kept a bed there in the hotel for a number of weeks. And on the day that they thought everything was much better, he was actually sitting up in the bed. Florence was reading some newspaper articles, some letters to him. They said he kind of got a strange look on his face, and that was it. Died there in the bed at the hotel. So Calvin Coolidge then became president. And the interesting thing about Calvin Coolidge, of course, he was vice president at the time. He was actually visiting his father in Plymouth, Vermont, when Harding died. He had gone to bed at 9 o'clock in the evening, as was his usual bedtime. August the 2nd, 1923, in Plymouth, Vermont. He had been on a little short vacation up there, visiting his father, doing some fly fishing. And at 2:30 in the morning, he was awakened and told that President Harding had died. Coolidge got up, hastily dressed, went downstairs to the parlor, which was lighted only by a kerosene lamp. His father did not have electricity in his home. And there he was addressed for the first time as Mr. President, words spoken by his father. Can you imagine? A copy of the Constitution was found in the house, and Calvin took the oath of office administered by his father, who was a notary public.
That's so interesting.
That's the first and only time that that occurred. No other president had been given the oath of office by their father.
Yeah.
So, and coincidentally, it's a good thing that he was a notary public, because they might not have been able to find anybody right away to give that oath of office.
Did you say it was in Maine, Massachusetts,
Vermont? Plymouth, okay.
Yeah, they might not have been too many officials lurking around there.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
If it had been just 24 hours later, Coolidge would have actually been in the home of a multimillionaire friend that he was planning to visit.
Oh.
But as luck would have it, it was a perfect setting. It was the old family farmhouse in the Vermont hills. It was his mother's Bible, on which he took the oath of office. By his bespectacled farmer father,
who was
a notary public.
I learned the other day that you don't have to take the oath of office on the Bible. You can take it on the phone book if you want to.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. It's a personal preference type of thing. I don't think, since Washington, any president has not taken the oath of office on the Bible, but you're absolutely right. But this was kind of the epitome of what Calvin Coolidge was. This little ceremony kind of appealed greatly to the American people. It was kind of perfect in his character. He was, you know, he was a tight-lipped person. He was just a Vermont farm boy. He had kind of a nasally twang from what I've heard. His father often said that Calvin could get more sap out of a maple tree than any other of the boys around here.
That's a good qualification for president.
And old Silent Cal got votes out of the people as he did sap out of the trees from the beginning of his career.
Yeah.
This is kind of an interesting fact. on his way up the ladder, he actually held more elective offices than any other president.
Hmm.
19. He held 19 different elected offices and was only once defeated for a school committee in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Hmm.
Only time he'd ever been defeated for an election. He was governor of the state in 1919 when it was supposed that he would not go any higher. And, of course, we all know he ended up in the White House because of the death of Harding.
Yeah.
And then he did run for a second term and was elected, and his second inauguration took place on March the 4th of 1925. I portrayed Calvin Coolidge once. I don't know if you were attending our dinners at that time, but Calvin Coolidge was a very difficult individual for me to portray because I love to talk.
Uh-huh.
And most of the presidents that I've portrayed in the past have been, you know, normal presidents that did quite a bit of talking. So it did present kind of a challenge to me to portray Calvin Coolidge and not be very verbal.
Silent and Cal, you mean?
Silent Cal.
Yeah.
And my favorite story about Calvin Coolidge, he's attending a dinner, a fancy dinner in Washington, D.C., shortly after assuming the office of president, about a year or so after. And I don't think he'd been elected on his own term yet. But anyway, he was attending this dinner, and we're seated at a table with several other people, and this lady was sitting beside him. And about halfway through the dinner, he hadn't spoken much, obviously, and this lady turned to him, and she said, "Mr. President, I have bet my husband that I can get you to say more than three words this evening to me." And he looked at her and said, "You lose." Two words.
That's good.
So he did serve another term and chose not to run again. And then follows by probably one of our worst presidents ever.
Really?
The old sweeper, Herbert C. Hoover.
Hoover, yes.
Herbert Hoover was kind of a... he was kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time, I guess you might say, because we all know that the Depression hit during his presidency.
He looks a little bit like James Cagney.
Yeah, he had kind of a look about him like that. I'm looking at his picture right now, and really wasn't a bad-looking man.
No.
But a little chubby, not particularly bad. But
I don't hold that against anybody.
Yeah. Are we getting close? I'm looking at my clock.
Yeah, we've got about 45 seconds. You wanna...
Okay. Well, again, he no president really ever started an administration under more favorable skies than what Herbert Hoover did when he took his oath of office in March of 1929. Really, the country was in pretty good shape. It was kind of basking in the sunshine of good old Calvin Coolidge. Whose administration had become known as kind of like, he was kind of the best known citizen. He was a humanitarian of international reputation. He was a genius of organization.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
By Marion, native and Miss America, Marilyn Meskey.
I had heard that.
What you didn't know was that after Marilyn taught them how to dance, that George gave her a gift.
Oh, really? What was that?
Two jugs of olive oil and a box of lemons.
George's calling card, WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Don't miss it.
GTG, BRB, OMW, be there in a few. You may think that these kinds of texts are fine because of their length, and you can easily send them at a stoplight. But no, answering one text can take your attention away from the road for 5 seconds. And traveling at 55 miles an hour, that's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Make good decisions. Don't text and drive.
Visit StopTextStopRex.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, Noise, and the Ad Council.
Well, we're back on with Fred Malone, and we're talking about Calvin Coolidge.
No, I'm sorry, Herbert Hoover.
We finished Coolidge.
So at Hoover's inauguration, he made this statement. He said, "We in America today are nearer to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of a land."
Read my lips.
He added, this is great here. He added, and I quote, "The poorhouse is vanishing from among us.
Oh, my.
Everlasting prosperity was the Republican campaign theme of a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage."
Yeah, wow.
When the crash came a few months after his inauguration, those glittering phrases were quoted from every corner of the land.
I'm sure they were.
He couldn't get away from it. Unfortunately, the poor old hapless president was blamed for the Depression, although it was really worldwide and it was kind of like a hurricane that they couldn't stop.
Yeah.
He was, in fact, the first president to intervene in a depression. No man really could have stemmed it. He really did try. We have to give him credit for that. He summoned to the White House for conferences all the industrial, commercial, financial, and labor leaders he could get, trying to do all kind of fact-finding. He kept reassuring the people that prosperity is just around the corner. Does that kind of sound familiar from what we just went through in the past administration?
It does. The
Depression, of course, as we know, deepened, and unfortunately Hoover became its symbol. If you've done any history studying at all, you're familiar with the phrase Hooverville.
Yeah.
The villages that came up where people had lost their homes were camping in tents all around the White House and in all the large cities.
Echoed by Pottersville in
It's a Wonderful Life. Unfortunately, people had nothing.
Yeah.
They were literally put out of their homes, so they did live in tents and shacks and shanties wherever they could throw a few boards together and build a house.
It was
sad.
Well, your parents and my parents both lived through it, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My grandparents right in the height of it, my mother growing up during the Depression and her siblings.
Yeah.
But the problem, again, and like you said, he looked a little like James Cagney. His appearance and his actions kind of heightened the impression that he was a cold individual. He really had no personality. He was kind of stiff, kind of high-collared. He had that round face of his.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't... It didn't put off much sympathy for people.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a Joe Biden,
okay.
I guess is what I'm saying. So really, given what transpired, he just was at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Didn't get a second inaugural.
Well, no, he did not. Interestingly enough, though, he was sworn in by Chief Justice William Howard Taft.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah, the only president I think that Taft did swear in at his time in mm-hmm. office. Hoover was the first president born west of the Mississippi, which was kind of an interesting fact.
Mm.
And he was the first to enter the White House a multimillionaire.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did he leave it as a multimillionaire?
I'm sorry, what?
Did he leave as a multimillionaire?
Yeah, I don't think he lost his riches.
Oh, okay.
According to what I've been able to read, he really wasn't born rich. He was born to a modest family. He was the son of a Quaker blacksmith.
Mm.
But his story, he was a self-made man.
Yeah.
He got into mining. He was a promoter in mining operations. He was a financier. He did a lot of had mining properties in China, Russia, Africa, Burma, all over the world, basically. So he was a self-made man for that part. But unfortunately, the Depression did him in, and he wasn't able to secure a second term. And of course, we probably aren't going to get any farther than our next man.
So, right, he's got an awful lot.
And, of course...
four inaugurals.
he was succeeded by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who became the first president to serve more than two terms and the first to be inaugurated in January.
Hmm.
Up until that time, everybody else was still being inaugurated in March, as was the original inauguration date.
Was that changed by an amendment?
Yeah,
the 22nd Amendment.
And the reason for that was the election was always held the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November.
Right.
And with the inauguration not occurring until March, you had a lame duck president
forever.
For 4 months.
Over
4 months.
Yeah.
And it's bad enough to have a lame duck president now for
77 days.
November and December and part of January. But can you imagine almost 4.5 months of being a lame duck president? So, yes, it was changed by the Congress, which made a lot more sense than what we'd had before. But anyway, FDR was born to considerable wealth. He, of course, was the fifth cousin to Theodore Roosevelt. Both were born fairly wealthy. I think FDR's family was a little more wealthy than what Teddy's family were. They were both Harvard graduates, and both began their political careers in New York. Both actually were governor of New York. And they both served as assistant secretaries of the Navy. Roosevelt, very much a lover of the water and sailing, as was Teddy. FDR sailed his own sailing ship. They lived in upstate New York on the water. And, of course, T.R. also lived upstate New York on the water. So there were a lot of similarities between the two. Both, of course, became president. So they both publicly vowed that they would refuse a third term, and they both broke their promises. Because we know Teddy tried to run again in 1912 and was unsuccessful, and of course Roosevelt ran four times. Even though the fourth term
probably shouldn't have the fourth
he
time.
He didn't last too long after he was elected. He died within 30 or 40 days.
Yeah, not very long
after being inaugurated. So or a month or two, something like that. I can't remember now off the top of my head. But
April 12th he died.
But
so
three
or four months
during his. His presidency, the Greatest Depression and the greatest war in the history of the world took place, and much to his credit, he defeated both of them. A number of his programs that he created, the New Deal, obviously are some still in existence today.
Social Security,
obviously, the salvation of so many people. Projects, the Works Project, the WPA, which created jobs for people that had none. The Civilian Conservation Corps created jobs for young men that had no job and no place to go.
And both of them have left monuments to their
indelible marks. Here in Ohio, we have the great fortune of having the WPA and the 3C creating a lot of the state parks.
Wasn't Hoover Dam built by the...
That was part of the WPA, the Work in Progress. Sure was. And the only national park that that we have here in Ohio, Cuyahoga National Park, was actually a 3C project and a WPA project that they worked on. Hocking County, where I was, where I grew up, spent most of my childhood. Lake Logan there was a civilian conservation lake.
I didn't know that.
Dug by the 3C. The Zaleski Forest in part of in Hocking and Ashland Athens County was this 3C a camp, and still is maintained today by trustees of the Ohio penal system. Those two things come to mind, as well as Social Security, which you know, unfortunately, when Social Security was created, it was supposed to be supplemental retirement plan, not a primary retirement plan. And unfortunately, over the years, a lot of people, probably over 50% of the people that earn Social Security, feel that it was created for them as retirement, but it really wasn't. It really wasn't. It was supposed to be supplemental to what you have done yourself.
I think I make all of about $14,000 off of mine. So.
Yeah, that's about average.
Yeah.
That's about average. But Roosevelt, he was an individual that didn't let adversity get him down. We all know, of course, that he suffered from infantile paralysis. That struck him at an early age. just before his paralysis struck in August of 1921. He was 39 years old. He stood 6'2" tall and weighed 175 pounds and was a very vibrant individual. Mm-hmm. He loved to swim. He loved to row. He loved to sail. He loved to wrestle with the kids. Very active individual. One evening at Capabello, the retreat, after a day of very vigorous exercise, followed by a swim in the icy waters of the Bay of Fundy, Roosevelt went to bed with a chill. The next morning, he had a high temperature. He complained of acute pain in his legs. In a few days, they were paralyzed with infantile paralysis, and he never walked again.
It echoes. I had a friend, Martin Blatt, in South Bend, and it's exactly what happened to him. And he ended up on a respirator, you know, the iron lung
for about
3 years. Yeah,
right. Well, and you know, when you talk about his condition, and he never wanted to be photographed in a wheelchair.
Mm-mm.
And to their credit. And boy, has this changed. To their credit, the press respected the office of the presidency and his wishes, and he was never, never photographed in a wheelchair by the press.
Right.
And when he did speak, he spoke with about 35 or 40 pounds of leg braces on each leg. He was able to walk with the help of either one of his sons or one of his aides. So he could walk to a podium by himself. So the American public, when they saw him walking, he was walking.
Mm-hmm.
He was walking, but never filmed in a wheelchair. And if he was filmed or photographed, he was standing or he was in his car.
And
his car had been specially fitted that he could drive it.
And he did, I've seen him sitting in a chair, but he had blankets over him, never saw it was a wheelchair.
Right.
Yeah.
And he actually developed his own wheelchair. He took a kitchen chair and had wheels put on a kitchen chair so it didn't look like a regular wheelchair.
Yeah.
And so it was very easy to cover up his legs when he was sitting. It just looked like he was sitting in a regular chair.
Well, we're down to our last minute and a half, so.
Well, we didn't get very far today.
I'm sorry.
So, well, it's my fault. I try to put what I think is interesting in some of these presidents, and I hope people continue to listen, and I hope they enjoy it.
Sure. Maybe we can finish this up next month.
Next month, we'll start with Give 'Em Hell, Harry Truman.
Well, tell me, Franklin Roosevelt had four inaugurals. Were they big things or not?
Yes. Well, no. Actually, the one during the war was not a big thing.
Okay. I can imagine that.
But the first, yes, fairly big. During the war, no, not so much. And the last one, no.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Now, the first one was, what year was that?
32,
yeah. So
well, the election was in 32.
There wasn't much
was
money
inauguration.
Going around at that time. So.
Yeah, and when I say fairly big, you know, I mean, not what we see today by any stroke of the imagination.
Right.
You know, a few thousand people.
Yeah.
But there again, the times were, we were right in the middle of a depression.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we'll pick up with Give 'Em Hell, Harry from Missouri.
All right. Well, very good. Hey, Fred Malone, thank you so much.
All right.
We've been talking.
Talk to you next month.
Okay, we'll talk to you next month. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right. That's Fred Malone from the Marion Historical Society. I always give him that credit just because that's how I got to know him. And we're just about going to get out of here. We'll be back in about 15 minutes with Swap Shop. Bye-bye.
You're listening to WWGH Radio.